office for about 10 minutes. There's setting up the theater. We're going to have it here. So I'd like to present Mr. Kurt Vonnegut Jr. He is, as the Highlander noted, a lecturer at the Writers' Workshop at the University of Iowa. And he's brought out quite a crowd. I'm really surprised. I'd like to read... I'd like to read to you as an introduction from the October 8th issue of the New Republic, which featured a cover article of Mr. Vonnegut, in which they wrote, Kurt Vonnegut Jr. is 44 years old and lives with his wife and six children. He's very prolific. In West Barnstable on Cape Cod, during the 1955 to 56 term and presently, he has taught at the Writers' Workshop at the University of Iowa and now teaches English in a private school on the Cape. He once worked for General Electric, his biography tells us, but Vonnegut is a scientist only in as much as he is interested in the science of living reasonably and kindly. He was also a volunteer fireman in Alpes, New York, badge number 155, which is interesting because the hero of one of his books was a volunteer fireman from Indiana. He has written six books and over 100 short stories, articles, and reviews. Among his fans are Conrad Aiken, Nelson Algren, Mark Conley, Jules Pfeiffer, Graham Greene, Granville Hicks, and Terry Southern. Mr. Vonnegut is, by all odds, the most readable and amusing of the new humorists. I give you Mr. Kurt Vonnegut Jr. on Dirty Books and The Single Girl.
This is obviously based on a hilarious misunderstanding that you're all here, and... He named my fans. There were six of them. Did you count them? While I was sitting outside, I heard a guy say, oh, hell, what's the subject? And he went in, and then he said, well, it had to be six to draw a crowd like this. I asked Mr. Weitzman whether Ferlinghetti had ever spoken here, because Ferlinghetti is a neighbor of yours. And he said, no. Well, Ferlinghetti and I passed in the air. Ferlinghetti is speaking in Iowa City, and I am speaking here. And I might as well have pretended to be Ferlinghetti, and he might as well have pretended to be Vonnegut, and we all could have pocketed the airline money. I am merchandising myself here using sex as or an automobile or a cigarette. It's a fraud. I wanted a crowd, and I've got one. Yes. Everything I know about sex, my wife taught me. And everything she knows about sex, her mother taught her, and her mother refused to discuss the subject. So, if you're going to have anybody here speaking about dirty books and the single girl, it should surely be a woman. Because this vast new industry has been opened up by women, not men, writing dirty books for single girls. And of course they get very wealthy and get to be editors of Cosmopolitan and so forth. I tried to research this subject somewhat in case somebody was going to hold me to it. And I did read some women's magazines before I got here, and I found out that Playboy is 20 years behind Cosmopolitan, 8 years behind McCall's, and 3 months behind Better Homes and Gardens. The sexiest thing about this, I guess, is that I composed part of it in a topless pizza joint across from the airport last night in Los Angeles. It was amazing. It was, you know, I'm not coming out here to corrupt you. You know, you're corrupting me because we don't have anything like that in Iowa or on Cape Cod. And, well, you know, with no clothes on, we don't have anything like that on Cape Cod or in Iowa. And as I say, I tried to study up on sex some. but it's too damn late for me to learn. As he said, I'm 44 years old, which is the age of Scott Fitzgerald at his death, of Chekhov at his death, and the literary life is a bitter one. It's bad for the health. Is at my age, George Bernard Shaw had only 50 years to live. I'm trying to get out of, as I say, lecturing on sex, so that's why you're all here. And I have an expert's opinion on why I shouldn't lecture on the subject anyway. This is Helen Gurley Brown, you know, is Sex and the Single Girl. And she says, in general, all creative types are nuisances to women. They are usually selfish, egotistical, temperamental, and gloomy when you are gay. This is an article called What Kind of Man Makes the Best Lover? They are also inclined to be poor, at least in the beginning. If an artist becomes successful, he probably will toss aside the mistress or wife who drudged through his cold water flat days and take up with a social butterfly better suited to his improved station. Well, I'm about to do that. I'm about to junk both the wife and the mistress. And though artists are supposed to lead free and easy sex lives, their antics seem as naive as a game of post office compared to the goings-on in the business world. Writers, although they can be charming, intelligent, well-bred, well-meaning, once you get them in bed, writers are poor bets as lovers. Why? Well, I'll let her answer it. Theirs is the hardest and most discouraging work there is. All that typing. Because writing is sedentary, indoor work, its practitioners are usually pale, sallow, and out of shape physically. They drink too much black coffee and smoke too many cigarettes, and so a disproportionately high number are dyspeptic or catarrhal. Writers develop strong tastes for convenience foods, that's in quotation marks, such as canned soup and chili, processed cheese, and instant coffee. Now, she's not thinking straight here because this is a horse on both the wife and the mistress if the guy is eating convenience foods, right? It's about time he left them when he was 44. They know nothing about women, and sexually they are the most repressed men in the world. If you meet a writer you find attractive, be prepared to make the overtures, or at least arrange for him to show initiative in a way that tells him he cannot miss. His ego gets all the shellacking it can take from those rejection slips, and he is not going to risk being turned down by you. A writer saves his best sexual fantasy for the printed page and will not dissipate or test them in real life. Ernest Hemingway once said, quote, if you make love while you are jamming on a novel, you are in danger of leaving the best parts in bed. That's kind of a dirty line, isn't it? But if talk is what you like, this is the place to get it. A man who writes for a living has little time left for anything else. He can never come out and play, and if he does, he feels guilty for not working. To have an affair with a married writer, you will need an apartment of your own. He undoubtedly works at home, and the thought of taking a hotel room is enough to paralyze him. If you marry a writer, count on laying your life at his feet. First is his sole support, and later is his interference runner, keeping the maids, children, bill collectors, editors, and even an occasional girlfriend out of his hair. Be sure you love everything he writes, or he'll likely sulk and stop eating and so forth. She says the conclusion of this article is that the best lovers are salesmen and gangsters. I swear to God, word of honor, everybody knew that Somerset Maugham was a fag and that Sinclair Lewis had bad breath, and I don't know anybody want to go into the field anyway. All right. Well, I certainly hope that my daughter, who is 18 now, will be lucky enough to fall in love with either a gangster or a salesman. There's nothing worse than a lover with katana. Actually, I know more about dirty books than I've been letting on. I don't write dirty books. But one time I was an expert defense witness for in a dirty book trial in Sioux City, Iowa. And all the magazines and books were from Los Angeles by a strange coincidence. And so was the defense attorney. And he hired me as an expert witness, and what we were defending was 6 novels about lesbians and about 26 pounds of nudist magazines. And the way the trial came up in Sioux City, just at harvest time, so that the only people who could be on the jury were wives, were elderly women. My interest in the case was twofold, is one, as a writer and as a teacher of writing, I'm deeply interested in the sanctity of the First Amendment, which is, as I'm sure you all know, talks about a number of things, but what it says of interest to writers is that Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or the press. And I incidentally regard this as sacred, and I'm about to make a screamingly funny joke. And I don't... And I don't want that to reflect on the dignity of my concern with the Constitution, but the screamingly funny joke is, one, I'm concerned with the First Amendment, and two, I like dirty books. So as expert defense witness, I had to go over there to Sioux City, and the lawyer and I were in a hotel room there, and he had stacks and stacks and stacks of books and magazines, which had been adjudged not dirty somewhere in the United States. Now, the court had passed on these. And so we had to go through all these, to see what was okay, this is really pretty raunchy stuff, some of it. And very gravely considering all this stuff, they're going to discuss this and all that. And I suppose somewhere else that the literary expert for the prosecution was going through the same magazine and go, ah, ah. Anyway. Well, it takes all kinds of people to make a world, and you can count on lawyers to find them. I'm very sorry that Lenny Bruce is dead. He's an extremely interesting man, and on the subject of dirtiness, I have 6 kids, and I don't care what they read. I can't imagine anyone being damaged by a piece of reading matter. Lenny Bruce got a very touching obituary in the New Yorker, which is surprising, because he was raw. The New Yorker is very smooth, and also the New Yorker is a very puritanical magazine. I don't know whether you realize that or not. It was founded by Harold Ross, who would not let anything the least bit smutty in. I don't know how many of you have read Kerber's book about Ross, incidentally, where Peter Arno did slip a dirty cartoon into the New Yorker, and Ross didn't get it. It showed a guy and a girl dragging the back seat of an automobile into a police station and saying, "We want to report a stolen car." And later on, when Ross hit the roof when he found out this was a dirty joke, he said, "Well, you saw it. What the hell did you think it was about?" And he said, "I didn't know. I just thought it had sort of an Alice in Wonderland quality to it." One of the Lenny Bruce routines, which is very much to the point, he's supposedly showing a blue movie, a stag movie, 2 children. Have any of you seen that or read it? I'm sorry I don't have a copy of it here. I just thought of it the other night in the Topless Pizza place, and they had no books at all there. Bruce says, or children, but he's going to do something to regret that. He's going to be like, oh, this is awful, and kiss me, and so forth, and like that. And finally, Bruce apologizes, and he has to take him to a horse movie, like Psycho, you know, see a girl, where they can see a girl being murdered in a shower bath. The obscenity business is silly, and I sympathize with people who want to protect themselves from it. It's sort of like wanting to protect yourself from litter bugs. You know, it makes the world a little less nice looking, and so I sympathize with people who want to do something in the form of legislation about it, and I'm going to say that for my snapper, I'm going to say how to outlaw dirty books without harming others. That's a whiz bang if I can do it, because the Supreme Court can't do it. All right, that'll be serious, too. Anyway, you know, even if you eliminated all the dirty books, you'd still have a lot of sex around. They had a survey years ago. I'm sure you've all read it because it's no chestnut, but they had a survey among Wellesley girls, I guess, finding out what aroused them most, you know, whether it was music or books or poetry or skiing or what. And 98% of them replied that it was the presence of men. All right, well, you know that the Supreme Court, we lost the case, incidentally, in Sioux City. And we were, what happened was we were counting on appealing it in the higher court. We figured we'd lose with the farmers' wives and that we would win on appeal by referring to Supreme Court decisions about dirty books. Quite liberal. And then the Supreme Court brought out this nutty law, brought out this nutty interpretation of the law now, which says in effect a book is dirty if the advertising for it is dirty. Which, as far as I'm concerned, makes an automobile pornographic. Because they Okay, I'm a teacher at the University of Iowa, where they have a famous writer's workshop. For 15 years I was a freelance writer and didn't do anything with that. And then a friend called up from Iowa and said, you want to teach out there? And I was ready to join the paratroops at the time. So I said, sure. And I went out there, and this is my second year out there. And it's quite an interesting thing. It's been going on since 1938 or so, founded by the poet Paul Engle. And it's been sneered at for a good many years for giving a master's degree for a creative thesis. Rather than doing scholarly work, you write a collection of short stories or novels or poems if you're a poet. And these have to be on a high level. The degree, the MA there, the MFA, Master of Fine Arts, it takes 2 years there, where a regular academic degree takes one. And the people who take our degree take the standard academic courses there, too. But we have, I guess we're one hotshot writing school, and the other is Stanford, which has a much smaller staff. Last year, Vance Borghele and Nelson Ogg and myself, and Jose Donoso, Chile's leading young novelist, and William Murray, an Irish writer, all taught there, and poets like Don Justice and George Starbuck and so forth. They've always had professional writers teaching there. And Nelson Algren was there last year, did not choose to come back this year. He found he wasn't getting any writing done, and the whole thing gave him a royal pain. He's a very interesting, good man, Nelson Algren is. But he was not an enthusiastic teacher. He found the idea of teaching creative writing absurd, and I'm afraid I do too, somewhat. But I will have some reservations about it. But Nelson and I got so depressed about the whole field last year that we really wanted to put on our master's degree examination, along with a whole lot of trick questions, you know. Is why write at all? Clean books or dirty books? You know, is why write? And everybody thought we were kidding, but I would have liked the guy to put on his master's exam. He's you know, why the hell write anything? Because nobody's reading anymore. But still, with no audience anymore, or with the audience dissipated to television and to film, we continue to turn out a hell of a lot of poets and writers. We have got 100 prose writers and 60 poets, which should every year. Which should, this is on the graduate level. It's a graduate department out there. It's a creative writing thing. You get into it by submitting a good piece of work. And we turn away 4 out of 5 there, and ordinarily the thing that gets the guy into the writer's workshop is an early published piece. It's usually an awful nice piece of work. But anyway, so what? Does the world need all these writers? I'm afraid not. There's a temptation, and Aldrin has had it. He said in an interview with the campus paper there that he didn't know whether he'd write anymore or not. Marcel Duchamp, you know, the guy who did Nude Descending a Staircase, made his reputation on that, what, the Armory Show in 1913, so stopped painting in 1922. This was his own work of art, was not painting anymore. You know, he's the nothing. The Duchamp painting now is the nothing. You know, there's a Duchamp painting. That's it. And would you rather have that or an Andy Warhol? As he says, you know, it's all the same. Anyway, Nelson last year, wanting to get out of Iowa himself, was telling all his students to get the hell out too. You know, he was doing, you know, his Hemingway blew his head off with a shotgun, Fitzgerald cranked his kidneys away, and this is no good, get out. And many of them did, incidentally. I have no idea what happened to them. I haven't been reading the casualty list from Vietnam for workshop people. I'm sure that some of Nelson's students have finally gotten it over there. Anyway, this Iowa experiment has been going on long enough. Most of our people have not turned out to be writers naturally because the odds are so terrible, and they have become teachers of creative writing. And every... every campus now has a teacher in creative writing and a course in it. And this is something like the Staphylococcus infection, you know, that started spreading from the hospital. Pretty soon everybody was suffering from staph. And nothing would stop it, you know, not sulfathiazole, not oreomycin, not streptomycin. Creative writing is now spreading out over the world. It's largely because of these people going out from Stanford and Iowa who cannot write but who can teach. And turn out more teachers on the home ground of creative writing. All right, well, I have run this off on a slide rule, and the entire Earth is going to be suffering from creative writing by the year 1973, which isn't far away. As Arnold Toynbee says that a world state is coming into being with a world religion, and he doesn't know what the shape of it is yet. Well, I know what it is. It's going to be one big writer's workshop. And that's going to include China. There's a tragic thing to have happen in a way, since all the magazines are dying and people don't read books anymore. But I'm making a living off this racket of encouraging people, so I shouldn't knock it, I guess. I have here Writer's Digest. There's imagine making $5,000 a year in your spare time. Fantastic? Not at all. Hundreds of people make that much or more every year and have fun doing it. Why not make money while learning to write? If you're the kind of author who gets his reward from writing beautiful thoughts that are read by no one but himself, read no further. Go to Iowa and get an MFA. That's what you do if you want to write that one. I am interested only in those who want to sell their work, who can gauge their success by the number of checks they can cash. With my new coaching system, you practice writing and have an opportunity to get paid for your work right from the beginning. You no longer need to spend dreary months just practicing without seeing your work in print. With my new method, the editors decide at once how you are doing. Their verdicts are often expressed in checks or cash that come to you almost week after week, and which can start coming almost immediately. Well, see, this is a racket now. It's my students, you know, they write short stories. I'm personally responsible for 25 of them. And they all send stories to Esquire, you know, and the stories come back, and I say, gee, what did I do wrong? They didn't buy this story. And I have to explain to them that Esquire publishes 18 short stories a year, perhaps, and that the population of the United States is not 200 million. But anyway, there are thousands of people paying money to the Iowa and to many places so that they can crack into print. The odds are just horrible, mainly because the magazine almost does not exist anymore. When I started out writing, which was about the time of the Spanish-American War, there was Liberty, there was Collier's, there were a lot of magazines that paid beautifully for short stories, and you could whipsaw them. As Collier's would try to steal you from Saturday Evening Post and so forth. Well, this is the idea of a magazine is technologically absurd now. It's, in a world of electronics, the fact that you should send each man a mail through the mail is a cylinder of paper, you know, like this, that weighs several pounds. It's foolish, because this is no way to communicate. And the Saturday Evening Post will eventually die. Very soon, the only place you're going to be able to publish a short story will be in subsidized reviews on the university campuses. When I started out, I was able to quit General Electric because I was making so much more dough from magazines. It was the best year I ever had was the year I quit General Electric. It's been generally downhill since then. But the money was just piling up in the corner. It was marvelous. You know, how long has this been going on? And I was doing what this guy says. I was tired of messing around. I wanted answers in checks I could cash, and that was how I was measuring my success. And I wouldn't get any rejection slips. I would self on the Collier's and then the Saturday Evening Post, and it was neat. Well, that's all over now. Nobody can do it. One touching thing that happened to the Saturday Evening Post was they hired away Rust Hills from Esquire. Rust is a fine arts man from Kenyon. I guess he had something to do with Kenyon Review for a while. And he was interested in excellent short stories, and the Saturday Evening Post hired him to come in there and buy the best stories he could, and they really were exquisite. Not one letter from the readers. The readers just did not give a damn. There was no reader response. People are not interested in short stories anymore. And it's very noble of the Saturday Evening Post to keep publishing them, but the readers do not give a damn, and I must confess that I do not read the fiction in the New Yorker anymore. I'll read the articles and the reviews and mean to read the fiction, but I won't. And the short story is really very sick. I don't know what the reason is. Is during the question and answer period, maybe some of you can start explaining to me or proposing questions that would help me explain why I don't read the New Yorker stories anymore, why I don't give a damn if I never read a piece of fiction again except in the Line of Duty at Iowa. Well, got a very funny line here. It says, sometimes I feel as though I'm giving lessons in horseshoeing or troubadour singing. At Iowa, you know, teaching a short story, how to write it. Well, Esquire buys 18, 20 stories a year. Playboy buys maybe 36. Saturday Evening Post buys maybe 48. New York City has 30 theaters, maybe. I think it's maybe down to about 28 now. And the population of the country, as I've said before, is 200 million, and all these people are sending in coupons to Writer's Digest. And part of it is surely what your generation has detected. You're right. You're a generally paranoid generation. But what you have, you've picked up some pretty good clues. And incidentally, on being paranoid, which your generation is, because a great line from Freud is that there there can be no paranoia without actual persecution, which is great. all right, but I try and keep in touch with the young people, and I ran into a jazz musician who hangs around the Union at the Union Building in Iowa. His name is Victor Huber, and he's turns out he has nothing to do with the university. He just hangs around the Union Building there because he looks like he belongs there, and he has worked out a scheme. He may be really crazy, I don't know. I haven't talked to him enough to find out. But my daughter, mentioned before, the one I hope marries a gangster, she knew him, and she went up to him. He was sitting there in the Union and said, "Hi, Vic." And he didn't pay attention to her. And she said hi to the guy sitting next to Vic, and he didn't pay attention to her. And they both held up cards, file cards, if you want to, standard file card. So she read one of them, and it said, "If you wish to communicate, please wait until you're recognized." And so she waited, and she was stood by, and she was finally recognized. And then she was handed a coin. Now, this coin is like the conch shell in Lord of the Flies. And you cannot talk unless you have this thing. And Vic Huber has been living this way. Last time I talked to him, he'd been at it for 10 days, and he must be up to about 14 or 15 now. And he absolutely refuses to communicate with anybody except on this basis, because he got tired of conversations that were pointless and where other people on the fringe of it would be talking, announcing their presences. And I have an Aunt Ina, a very nice lady, but she has a mannerism as when somebody else is talking, while she's going, And I said, "If President Johnson had this problem, would you listen to him?" And he said, "You bet I would." But he said, "According to the rules of the game, Johnson would have to listen to me next, and I have a lot to say to him." So, all right, but try it. I think you'll find it works fine. And it was, you simply refuse to speak to anyone who will not play the game. Okay. All right, as a writer, as a teacher of short stories and everything, and with people paying tuition and all that, and people doing their homework and everything, I've occasionally asked myself, what in the hell do you think you're doing? Because there's no work for these people to do when they get through, except to teach creative writing. And I have tried to work up some answers that cheer me up some. And one of the things I've said to myself is, you are giving society articulate, sensitive creatures it needs. For writers are like canary birds, which miners take down into the coal mines. When something is really bad, they keel over first. But then I realized that politicians don't notice fainting canary birds. Franklin Delano Roosevelt read Mickey Spillane, and John Kennedy read James Bond, and President Johnson claims to read Robert Lowell, and I don't believe him. And as far as that goes, Johnson won't even listen to Dr. Spock. So, okay. Well, the Iowa situation really didn't used to be very tragic because the students weren't very good. It was sort of a cultural uplift thing in Middle America, and people did brush shoulders with the Wings of the Muses there, and got to be fans of poetry, and the business of the workshop wasn't too serious. Now a terrible thing has happened because of the draft laws and because of the general respect for education. We now have the good writers. We've been operating out there for years, have caught, I think, a remarkable number of good writers. We have a corner, I think, possibly along the Stanford. Really good guys. Now what the hell are we going to do about them? Because it's no joke. Writers didn't used to go to college. They were all dropouts. Perry Mark Petrakis, a friend of mine, was in a dirty book trial in Chicago. That's one of the big ways to make money in this business is to be an expert at a dirty trial on either side, you know, to make it. But anyway, Petrakis was on the stand, and the prosecuting attorney said, "Mr. Petrakis, you're here as an expert, and I happen to know you have no college degree whatsoever." And Petrakis was able to reply, "Sir, no man who ever won the Nobel Prize for Literature for America went to finish college." And the lawyer said, "That's very interesting." And it is. And it is interesting. And writers' workshops have to think about this now, because it is a fact. It is a fact that the writers have not come from colleges. They've customarily come from newspapers in this country. The European experience is something different. I was a newspaper man and also a dropout. I have no degree, and I have no Nobel Prize either. And my wife, I understand that this place was once going to be the Swarthmore of the West, but my wife went to the Swarthmore of the East. And she just got creamed by a college professor, so she would be a writer now. She made Phi Beta there. She was an excellent student, and the courses were excellent. And I think what went wrong was that these people, that she was taught good taste before she could write well. And I've seen this happen frequently. That people, having been taught what is good, are just sickened by what they do at the age of 17, 18, 19, and so forth. So it's a very destructive thing to hold up good models for young people, because young people will not go through a bad period knowing what good is. What you need really is a barber's period there, where you have no idea what's good. And getting back to Harold Ross again, the founder of the New Yorker, you know, a very sophisticated magazine, and his clothes always looked as though he slept in them. He did an awful lot to upgrade magazine literature and so forth, and he knew almost nothing of what to his benefit. He simply trusted his intuition. There's a story about Ross sticking his head out of the office, you know, and saying, hey, you know Moby Dick? Was he the guy or the whale? Is he? He didn't even know that much, you see. And I approve of this innocent approach to art. And I think a good many college writers are destroyed by well-meaning teachers who show them masterpieces, you know. What we do in the workshop is what we've done for years. It's what we're doing to the good writers. We didn't used to have good writers, as I said before, but we've got one damn thing. It's called form of fiction, and we hold up beautiful models, you know, the big trunk here, and we pull out Madame Bovary and say, "Ooh, look at that," you know. And one thing after another, and I think this is harming them. I've been thinking, what the hell are we really going to do now that we've got writers? And one of the things I thought we might do is to make them unhappy. Is to frustrate them, you know, is to take their girls away from them if we can, is to have them falsely arrested, falsely accuse them of things, and steal little things from their apartment. rearrange your furniture, you know, and poor Johnson's baby powder in their typewriter and all that. Because one element that has been noticed in writers, which is the same one that's been noticed in your generation, is paranoia, is this over-responding to life. Most people Most people can take life as it comes, you know, but not the paranoid and not the writer. And he's really got to respond, and he's really got to get down and hit back, even though he hasn't been hit. He just imagines he's hit. We've got a painting department at Iowa, a very good one. It's much older than the writer's workshop there. And, you know, it was Grant Wood and Thomas Hart Benton, and some of those people there. They have very good faculty and still do. And I proposed to a guy in the art department that before a guy can get his master of fine arts degree in painting, that he has to cut off his ear and send it to a prostitute. And he thought this was reasonable, but he said that there was no prostitution in Iowa. And I told him that's how much he knew, that there were several whorehouses in Waterloo. Anyway. And then he suggested that we shouldn't give a degree in writing until a candidate had proved he could stay drunk for a solid year, like Malcolm Lowry. And I was willing to accept that. But what do I actually do for these good writers? And they are good, and I'm embarrassed that we have them because we don't know what to do with them. Is I talk to them about as cynically as I talk to you, as though it did not matter. I happen to think it does matter. I'm giving a seminar in trash, which is Valley of the Dolls, The Carpetbaggers, is a flying saucer book, and several books about Kennedy, which is no reflection on my feelings on Kennedy, simply all the goddamn books and covers. These are all non-books. This is the age of the non-book, and we, you know, is the non-book is not taught in universities. Well, it's being taught now. And I happen to know something about how to write The Valley of the Dolls. These are planned books, you know, now. It is known how to write a bestseller. Years ago, people said they didn't know how to write a bestseller. Well, it's known now. And the bestseller industry is based on several facts. One of them is there are five big paperback houses in this country, and they pay a lot of money for a big book. They need, each of the five needs a big book every month. Strangely enough, they need a big book every 11 months out of the year. They skip Christmas, but each one has to have a big fat name. Dell book, a big fat name. Avon book, a big fat name. Fawcett book. And they pay a hell of a lot of money for a bomb. And there are not enough of these books around, so an industry exists to produce these books. And get the money from the paperback houses. Now, what is wanted is a 19th century novel with a sex scene every 20 pages. It should be based on rumors of somebody famous, preferably in show business. I'm not kidding you. I have a friend who's doing this now, and he got a bestseller kit. The letter covering the kit says there are three kinds of books. There are fact books, there are fiction books, and there are bestsellers, which are a combination of the two. Now, if you take a look at Valley of the Dolls, it's a 19th century novel, sex scene every 20 pages, and it is based on rumors of the life of Judy Garland. Now, nobody says it's about Judy Garland, and the author is not to really think Judy Garland when he writes this thing. He's just to sort of deal with rumors of Judy Garland, see, is they're not going to sell a Judy Garland thing except subliminal. But so if you want to do it, you can make a hell of a lot of money. It's over $100,000, isn't it? Vance Bourgeli, who's a very good writer, he's on the faculty with me there, just had his big, made his first really big score. He's been pooping along. Very well reviewed, very well thought of, and so forth, but he's never had a great big sale. Well, he's got one now. He dropped by and saw me on Cape Cod, and he was sort of pursing his lips and everything, and we were talking about one thing and another, and finally I said, well, I had rather good news this morning, and I said, what was that? The Literary Guild just picked up my book, and the guarantee is $35,000, which is very nice news. And the name of his book is The Man Who Knew Kennedy. You see? Okay. In this business, you have to get used to huge sums of money. You know, it's $400,000 for up the down staircase and $35,000 for Vance Bourgeli and everything. It's a little like being in a company assault, you know, with the United States Navy standing offshore with 12-inch guns, you know. There's these tremendous shells go over your head all the time. You know, half a million, 100,000, and all that. I haven't been hit by one yet. I did see a Hollywood agent yesterday, and I'm not going to charge you for that side trip either. That was... and he said to me, whatever you're writing, have a strong male or female figure. So I'm going to. One thing I quite seriously feel my good students out there ought to do is familiarize themselves with technological advances. Now, particularly in biology, sensational changes that are going on, and also in cybernetics, which are reflecting quite seriously on man's opinion of himself, and writers, to be any damn good now, are going to have to respond to the technology. They can no longer ignore it. It's no longer a tin Lizzie parked out front. It's all around us and governing our lives. So I have asked my readers, please, for the love of God, if they're going to write about this particular decade, to subscribe to Scientific American, and some of them are. But I believe the canary bird image, I actually believe. I think our usefulness is there. Where are they going? All right, well, that's all right. I really do believe the artist is a very useful man, and I'll tell you how to detect a dirty book. No, I really will, and that'll be the end. There's a guy named Edmund Bergler who psychoanalyzed more writers than anybody else. He's written a book called The Writer and Psychoanalysis. Incidentally, psychoanalysis doesn't help anybody except writers. It does help writers who are blocked because they can't write. They've freed up. And you go to Bergler and he unblocks in about 6 weeks. But anyway, Bergler has analyzed enough writers that he has been able to draw a distinction between a hack and a creative writer. And he says that the hack can accept advice from other people. If somebody would come up to the hack and say, hell, I've got a hell of a good idea. There's this girl you see, and the hack says, yeah, that's me. And goes and writes a story. And a creative writer absolutely cannot take advice from anyone. And a sign of an approaching nervous breakdown in a creative writer is where he begins asking for advice. This is true. Is where he will say, I have this situation, you know, and the guy's acting this way. Why would he be acting this way? Or help me out of this or that. When a creative writer starts to ask for advice, he's going over the edge. The hack will do anything for money. The hack is a nice guy, incidentally. It is a very good writer, but he is not serving his own inner impulses as a creative writer is. The creative writer is supposed to be a cultural traitor, and we're supposed to protect him from the police, no matter what he writes. Because, you know, he has to say what he has to say. So they've had a lot of trouble distinguishing, law has, between a dirty book and a work of art. So I propose that it be that if a man is told to write a dirty book and write it, that's a dirty book. If a man on his own feels the need
write a dirty book. That's a work of art, and that's no joke. That's no joke. I think that that's the extent to which the First Amendment ought to protect people. And you've got Henry Miller home free. And so, okay, goodbye.
But the regulations and the Kerr directive say that all lecturers in the University of California who have said anything controversial, I don't know whether he has, but dirty books sounds very controversial to me, have got to put themselves in the grueling task of a question and answer period. So anybody who has anything they'd like to ask Mr. Vonnegut now, please go ahead. We're paying for it.
Flow has died up because everybody's caught on the very most technical industry.